There's live music, festival market, walkabout entertainment, and lots more. Check out jellyrecords.com. That's jelly-records.com.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin Summers goes head-to-head with former Foreign Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkin tonight. Well, not quite. Malcolm Rifkin's recorded from Wednesday night, or Thursday night, news night on the BBC. But the Syrian government army is retaking some of the final strongholds, such as Aleppo and Homs, from the Syrian rebels, who are now, it seems, falling out amongst themselves. Nevertheless, the Foreign Office seems to be doing everything it can to justify sending arms to the rebels. Martin Summers will have a little exchange with former Foreign Secretary and Chairman, more importantly, of the Intelligence and Security Committee. That's Sir Malcolm Rifkin tonight. Plus, the prohibition of drugs in Britain is arguably doing more than anything else to support organised crime. We invited Avon and Somerset's drug policy lead, Chief Inspector Paul Brunt, on to discuss things, but he's out of the force area, we're told by the press office at Portishead. We'll keep trying though, and meanwhile we'll talk to Chris Bovey, we hope, this evening from Anti-Prohibition Campaign Normal. So let's start, Martin, this evening actually with business of what's been going on in Syria. A key Free Syrian Army rebel has been killed by an Islamist group, we hear today. This is a link to Al-Qaeda. Kamal Hamani from the Free Syrian Army has actually been killed by Al-Qaeda.
Well, whatever Al-Qaeda is, it's the Al-Nusra Front, probably, which is affiliated to Al-Qaeda, supposedly, whatever that may mean. I mean, basically, it's a terrible tragedy for the people of Syria, isn't it? Let's face it. And outside powers are pouring in weaponry and special forces. And
is it as simple that the Syrian army is now winning this war, and the various people are now falling out who were fighting them?
It's hard to judge from this distance, but the fact is that they kept on saying Assad will go after Assad goes, when Assad goes, Assad's going to go, you're going to go, aren't you, Assad? But he's still there, and his army have actually thrashed the people who are trying to push him out.
Well, the BBC BBC are calling it a civil war within a civil war, but Paul Wood, BBC reporter.
Well, I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and civil wars within civil wars are actually normal. Once you've got loads of young men completely freaked out running around with guns, then, you know, anything can happen. And it's not just one guy, two sides, one of whom is bad, the other is good, or both of whom are as bad as each other, whatever. What you've got is lots of people with guns, and that is always very messy.
Kamal Hamami, that's the guy that's been killed today, also known as Abu Basir el-Ladkani, worked in a butcher's shop before the conflict began, but went on to form one of the FSA's key brigades in his native port city of Latakia. He's believed to have met members of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant in Latakia to inform them of a planned offensive in the area before being ambushed and shot dead whilst at a meeting with Al-Qaeda to organise some battle plans.
Yes, so in other words, the terrorists inside Iraq who plant bombs outside Shia mosques, and of course we've just had a bomb outside a mosque in Tipton near Coventry today in Bristol, in Britain, they are regarded as terrorists in Iraq, but in Syria they are freedom fighters because they're against the Assad regime. And of course most people in Britain realise by now that this is incredibly complicated, and the idea that the British and the Americans and the Israelis are just honest brokers trying to help the Arabs sort out their problems and bring them democracy. What a joke. Just think of all the bloodshed that we've had in the last 10 years.
I mean, everything seemed to be going on in Syria very, very differently to what happened in Libya. It's a very similar thing. The West seemed to want the similar thing, to overthrow a dictator and also to impose a no-fly zone. Why has it been so very different in Syria, Martin?
Because it's once bitten, twice shy. I mean, the Chinese and the Russians agreed to a no-fly zone over Syria because the West suggested it was just going to be a humanitarian thing to stop the Libyans bombing protesters. Of course, there's no real evidence that they were ever bombing protesters, and the plan to have a no-fly zone was put in a long time before Operation Southern Mistral 2011. People should look that up, do a search on that, and you'll see that there was a plan to overthrow Gaddafi a year before it actually kicked off. And Roland Dumas, who used to be the French foreign minister, is up on the internet saying, well, there was a plan to overthrow Assad before any protests took place. So in other words, we are being told a pack of lies by our government about what's going on. They basically tried to overthrow Gaddafi and Assad, and Morsi, of course, was and Mubarak were also overthrown by the US via the army. So in other words, we're presented as the Arab Spring as being this kind of spontaneous uprising, and these people are being repressed, and now we've got to help them. In actual fact, the whole thing was orchestrated by the West in order to create political facts on the ground. It's not all worked out the way they hoped. In particular, the Syrian army has turned out to be much more formidable than the West imagined. And of course, the other thing, of course, is the Russians have now found evidence of chemical weapons use by the rebels. And I also read on the internet yesterday that the Syrian army have captured huge drums of potential chemicals for use in chemical weapons in a big firefight. So the narrative is getting more and more threadbare from the point of view of people like William Hague, but nevertheless they keep on banging on about it, and forces are being prepared and deployed. The Israelis, let's remind ourselves about them, they have been banging on that they want a war with Iran. They've been banging on about it for 5 years, and you know what, this summer they're going to get it. And I think people in this country who think that we can watch this stuff in dispassionately and say, oh, well, what's going on over there, we don't really know, well, never mind, nothing to do with us. It is to do with us. Everybody over there knows very well it's to do with us. And of course, big wars are a big shock.
Well, it was Tuesday night, actually, that Newsnight screened an entire episode discussing Syria. And Sir Malcolm Rifkind was putting the case for arming the rebels. He is the chairman of the supposedly unbiased Intelligence and Security Committee, who we've criticised several times on this programme, particularly because of the links of Sir Malcolm Rifkind to defence companies and the fact that he's a director of one of those advisors to defence companies. So clearly there is defence money coming into his pocket, as well as others on that committee being slightly questionable, including one of them who wrote a report on the Iraq war, which seemed to really not get in any way to the bottom of finding out about this business of weapons of mass destruction. Now, the Butler report, that's what it was. Martin, when I saw that, I thought it would be really nice to have Martin in the studio arguing with Sir Malcolm Rifkind and putting a few points to him, so I'm going to give you the chance to do that now. And so here is Malcolm Rifkind from Tuesday night's Newsnight, putting the case for arming the Syrian rebels.
Thank you. The question of whether we give help to the moderate, secular Syrian opposition is one of the most difficult decisions we will be asked to reach. There are good arguments on both sides of the question. Like most people, I began when this war began hoping it would be a civil war, that the outside world would not have to intervene. I was against the Iraq war. I don't normally support intervention in other people's countries. But as we have seen, intervention has already been happening over the last 2 years. Russian and Iranian arms have flown in to help the Assad regime. Hezbollah troops are fighting with the Assad regime against the Syrian people. So it's against that background that we now have to address that question.
Well, I think that's just basically misinterpreting the situation. He says it's complicated. You've got Hezbollah troops, of course, who are Shia, like most of the leadership in Syria. You've got the Iraqi elected government supporting Assad. Morsi was removed last week in Egypt because the Egyptian army refused to get involved in fighting in Syria. I think Malcolm Rifkind should stick to his own rules and say, let's not interfere in other people's business.
And it's not, as you have heard, about sending an army into Syria. It's also not a question of whether Britain by itself takes action. We are part of an international community. There are already over 100 countries, more than half the United Nations, that have recognized the Syrian opposition as the legitimate voice of the Syrian people. And that includes most of the countries of the Arab League. So it's whether the international community should intervene. And I believe that it is both ethically justified as well as politically desirable. And it's basically two reasons. First of all, the humanitarian reason. Already over 100,000 men, women and children have been killed, mostly because of a brutal onslaught by the Assad regime against its own people. The more this war continues, the more likely we are to see not 100,000 but 200,000 a year from now. And even if Assad takes Homs, that will still be a very long war.
Well, I mean, in Iraq, people have been dying every day as well. But we're not talking about that, because the regime in Iraq, the Maliki regime, supports Assad, even though they won the democratic election, if there was a democratic election in Iraq. And it's not a question of just having dictators who are removed by popular force. What you've actually got is a very complicated situation. Lots of different factions involved. Hezbollah, he's mentioned them earlier, they are in control of the government of Lebanon with their Christian allies. And in actual fact, they are moving into Syria to protect their villages, which are mostly Shia, from the Sunni rebels. And lots of people have died in Syria. Many of them have been killed by the regime. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. But many of them have been killed by the rebels. And there isn't actually good guys and bad guys here. And the other thing I would point out, that in actual fact, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and it's been reported in the British press that British special forces have already been inside Syria. People have got to realise that we're already engaged in the Middle East. Britain and the US and countries like that are not seen as kind of passive, neutral countries. They're seen as the enemy. And eventually, of course, we will be treated as the enemy, because we are.
The second reason is that the war will only come to an end when both sides recognise that there has to be a political solution, that no side can win entirely on military grounds. And that will only happen, it's my final point, that will only happen when Assad recognizes that he has to agree to a new transitional government.
Okay.
At the moment, he has no incentive to make any such concession.
Well, this is really interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, the Russians have been pushing exactly this line from the very beginning. Let's get everybody around the table, like in Bosnia or anywhere else, and have a negotiated solution. And the sticking point has always been that the rebels will not negotiate with Assad, and therefore he's got to step down before we can have a transitional regime. Now, Assad is turning around and saying, look, my army are winning on the ground. You are not in a position to tell me I cannot be part of the negotiation. I'm happy to negotiate. I'm coming to Geneva. You know who's not going to turn up in Geneva? The rebels, because they're losing. And if they come to Geneva, the deal they'll get won't satisfy them. So they're saying we don't want to talk. So when Rifkin says we've got to have a political solution, what political solution when you don't want to include Assad and his army, who are winning the war?
Well, one of the key questions which Sir Malcolm Rifkin had to respond to was whether or not the whole thing would be legal. Would it actually be a violation of international law to arm these rebels?
No question about the level of risk we accept that the weapons might end up in the wrong hands. Now, of course, you can't give 100% guarantees, but no. Think logically. The only people who don't have weapons at the moment are the Free Syrian Army. The jihadis already have them. Assad already has them. Why should the Free Syrian Army, if it at long last gets weapons, why should it wish to hand them over to people who have already got them and who are their own sworn enemies in the terms of the long-term future of Syria?
Well, I mean, this idea of the moderate rebels, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Western powers, I mentioned Roland Dumas earlier, who used to be French foreign minister, he said there was a plan to try and set up an insurgency inside Syria and Libya before any protest took place. So it's totally disingenuous of Sir Malcolm Rifkin to come out and say, and there's also something unreal about this. We're talking about whether we should supply weaponry. And he just says the Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front have got loads of weaponry. Where do you think they got it from? I think they got it from the Turks, from the Qataris and the Saudis, who are our allies. Incidentally, when are we starting the armed struggle against the medieval regime in Saudi Arabia? Because the message is absolutely clear, isn't it? There's one thing, what we've got to do, the people in Egypt have got to do to get rid of the army. They need to start fighting the army, and then the RAF will come in and bomb those Egyptian tanks for them, as we did in Libya, and then we'll have a popular revolution in Egypt. A few people will die, but just like in Syria, in the end, we will have a pro-Western democratic regime. But first of all, the army has to be smashed. The Free Syrian Army, the Free Egyptian Army, the Free Bahraini Army, let's get the guns out. It's just nuts. The Russians are saying, if you arm the Syrian rebels, we will carry on. And the Iranians were saying, we will carry on arming Assad, and it could end up with your soldiers, Russian soldiers, fighting British soldiers. Fantastic.
While we had a European arms embargo, or if there was a United Nations arms embargo, that clearly would make it improper to provide arms. But the idea that because Assad, according to the Russians, is still the government of Syria, well, that may be the Russians' view, but I mentioned earlier over 100 countries of the United Nations have said they recognize the Syrian opposition as the legitimate spokesman of the Syrian people. Even the Arab League has expelled Assad and has invited the Syrian opposition to take the Syrian seat in the Arab League. So who is the legal government and who are the rebels?
That's an interesting question. Who is the Arab League? Oh, it's Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, all these countries where they don't have any elections at all. They're the Arab League. And of course, the neighbours of Syria, that is Lebanon and Iraq, are fairly clearly supporting Assad for sectarian reasons. Because the Christians and the Shiites and the Alawites and the the secular people do not want to see a Sunni-led regime in Damascus any more than the people in Egypt wanted to see Morsi running it and all the rest of it. This is far, far more complicated than he imagines. And it's not just about Syria. The Chinese and the Russians are getting fed up of the Western approach to everything, which is let's have a war, and let's not forget that all of this is ultimately about Iran, and we've got to stop the Iranians getting nuclear weapons, otherwise goodness knows what might happen. In fact, if the Iranians had nuclear weapons, it would do nothing at all apart from calm the situation down. And ultimately, this is pouring petrol on a fire, and Sir Malcolm Rifkind is way out of line with British public opinion, which doesn't know much about these things we're talking about, but certainly doesn't want to get involved. And people who know what's going on want to get involved even less. This whole idea that the West has got a duty to fix the politics of the Middle East is absurd. If we want to fix the politics of the Middle East, the first thing you can do is make the Israelis withdraw behind the green line, insist that the Bahrainis have a democratic election. If they don't have a democratic election, then we've got to go to war, just like in Syria. Because if we don't get democratic elections and they're torturing and killing people, well, at certain points, pacifism doesn't do, does it? It doesn't do in Syria, it doesn't do in Bahrain, it doesn't do in Israel, it doesn't do anywhere. Everybody got to get up and fight for their rights. Absolutely, Mr. Rifkin, we're right for it. And when the Bahrainis plant a bomb outside your house because you are killing their people and they think you're to blame, you will say, great, fantastic, because we're all in favour of fights and wars, and that's the business, isn't it? Sometimes we've just got to walk the talk and plant the bombs and shoot everybody, haven't we?
Well, Martin, one of the most important points that he's trying to make there was about the legalities of it, which was to do with the EU arms embargo. Now, what he's saying is now the EU arms embargo is no more. It was a couple of weeks ago. There is no more of an embargo. Oh. Then that means that it's fine under international law to supply weapons to the Syrian rebels.
Well, in actual fact, the only people who wanted to lift the arms embargo were the British and the French. All of the other members of the EU were not at all happy about the idea, especially the Germans. The Germans were saying this is nuts. But they were overruled. No doubt they were told that various things to do with trade or whatever wouldn't go through unless they agreed to allow the British. And then the British and the French said, we want to lift the arms embargo, but we don't actually want to do anything yet because we haven't agreed what to do, which is absolutely stupid because the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrian regime just interpret this as grandstanding. Basically, on the ground, the position is absolutely clear. The Syrian army is winning, and that's all there is to it.
Well, on a related topic, we've finally seen the deportation of Abu Qatada this week. So let's go to the Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, who gave her view, supposedly an opposition view, on the deportation of Abu Qatada.
The entire House should strongly welcome the work that the Home Secretary and her junior minister have done to get Abu Qatada finally on a plane back to Jordan to stand fair trial. This is a good result, not just for the Home Secretary, but for the country. In his home country, Abu Qatada stands accused of plotting terror attacks against a school and against tourists. It is right he should stand trial for those offences and for justice to be done.
Now, this is supposedly an opposition view, Martin. What are your thoughts about the way that Abu Qatada has been held here in this country and now has been sent to Jordan?
Well, let's talk about Jordan. They don't have democratic elections in Jordan any more than they do in Syria. And if they did have democratic elections, people like Abu Qatada might win. So we're sending him back to be put on trial by a non-democratic regime, which we support. And, of course, he's exactly the kind of person who in Syria we're calling a freedom fighter. Can't people see how ridiculous this has all become? What's going on here is neo-imperialist 19th century politics and scaremongering of the worst kind. Abu Qatada claims he's innocent. Even if he wasn't innocent and he was a terrorist in terms of the state in Jordan, Jordan is not a democratic state. Hey, wake up! In Syria, when you haven't got a democratic state, we say it's great for the Free Syrian Army to start fighting back. Abu Qatada was fighting back. We should give him a medal. Give him a rifle. Never mind sending him back. Look, see how illogical all of this has become.
Does he, do you think maybe he might skip jails, skip over the border and start fighting in Syria with Al-Qaeda?
Well, who knows? He's in Jordanian custody now, no doubt potentially torturable, as we all, the Jordanian regime is not a democratic regime any more than the Saudi regime is, the Bahraini regime, or any of the other regimes which we sell so much weaponry to. Now, if we're going to have a rule that says if there's a non-democratic regime, an armed uprising against it is justifiable, and remember, don't forget, when Gaddafi died, Hillary Clinton said was, we saw he died, and she was laughing about the fact that he died on video with a bayonet up his backside, and in fact the evidence suggests it was actually French special forces who did the assassination. Now, if people want to think that that's a good way to carry on politics, that's fine, but no crying for mummies when it really gets going. No crying for mummies, we're not interested.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Another bit of news today is that Microsoft have been giving encrypted message access to the National Security Agency. Now, Martin, I'm afraid I'm guilty of having Windows on my computer. I've been a little bit annoyed that Microsoft would just hand access to my computer over to the National Security Agency or GCHQ.
You poor dear. You poor dear.
Is it? I mean, should we be surprised about this?
Not really.
But I mean, ultimately, does it mean that there is no such thing as security on the internet?
I would pretty much say so. I mean, basically, people have got to realise that using any kind of electronic communication, that is buggable, and it always has been. But as long as you're not doing anything that you don't want to be public about, it's not a problem. But of course, if you are a terrorist like Abu Qatada or the Provisional Army,
you've got to make sure that you don't use electronic goods.
What if you're a legitimate political activist? This information can be used to actually stifle campaigns. We've had police infiltration as perfectly legitimate campaigns talked about over the last few weeks, months, and even children being sired with activists.
Indeed, and you could argue that we haven't got a democratic society either, and perhaps we should take up arms to change our government. Oh, hang on a minute, we were doing that for 30 years in Ireland, weren't we? Although Middle England didn't notice.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Also, Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, has found that there's not very many countries that want him to grant him asylum, and he is now seeking temporary asylum in Russia.
Well, I understood that various Latin American countries were quite keen to have him, but he can't get from Russia to those countries. A bit like Assange, they won't allow him to go to the Heathrow to fly to Ecuador. I mean, that's the latest I heard on this. I mean, the fact is, you see, they're trying to do this trade deal, for example, between the EU and the North Americans. And if the communications of all the negotiators are being bugged, as they obviously are, then we can't have a serious negotiation, can we? And so you can see the implications of all of this. And I think what the Russians are saying to Snowden is just be quiet and you can stay in Russia. You can tell us everything you know, but don't tell everybody, because we're going to war with the Americans and we need the information.
Do you think so?
I think that's the way the Russians are thinking. I'm sure that the Russian military will be thinking in terms of when we fight NATO rather than if.
Also, Snowden has been meeting Amnesty and Human Rights Watch at Moscow Airport. He's emailed a lot of international human rights organisations to ask them to fly in and have a chat with him.
Well, yes. He is another one of these people exposing to us what our state has become. The real problem, of course, is when people like William Hague say, as long as you've not done anything wrong, you have nothing to fear. The problem is that we suspect that NATO intelligence services are terrorists. And we've got lots of evidence to suggest that, going back to the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, the Gladio structures, the sort of things we've talked about on this show many, many times. So when they're collecting all of this data, it's not to protect us. It's in order to carry through their nefarious plans to manipulate us. And I think that we've really reached the point where we could argue that there isn't a functioning democracy in the West. And as I said earlier, like the Free Syrian Army, maybe it's time to take up arms. I'm just putting it forward as a suggestion.
Well, Edward Snowden is calling on international groups to offer protection to him. He's actually finding that every country pretty much that he's asked for asylum, has there been a lot of diplomatic pressure by the US has been put on him, and he's calling that unlawful.
Well, I mean, there is he is being accused of being a spy, and he's in actual fact what he's doing is exposing the US's spying. And in actual fact, it's the US government that should be in the dock, not Snowden.
Well, we should.
Ask the German politicians, even the conservative ones. They're furious.
Well, we should certainly see about that. Also, Martin, you mentioned briefly earlier on that the UK planned the war on Syria before the unrest began.
Yeah.
And this is a French ex-foreign minister has said this on French television. The statement by Roland Dumas came during a recent interview with French parliamentary TV network LCP. And he's saying that Britain had been planning a war against Syria for 2 years before the unrest and trouble broke out in the Arab country. So, I mean, are we sitting around, do you think, planning civil wars in lots of countries, looking ahead a few years' time down the road? And is there any way of it, we can have a verifying this guy's claim?
Well, we are not planning civil wars, but our government is. And I think it's very significant that the former French foreign minister said, oh yes, they planned to overthrow Assad years before there were any protests. The West is now trying to manipulate protests in developing countries in order to get regimes they want for various geopolitical goals that they are pursuing.
Well, what evidence can you... I mean, surely you can't actually orchestrate a mass uprising.
You can if people are already upset with the government and all the rest of it. It's perfectly feasible. And there would be legitimate reasons why people might want to change the government of their country. The problem is that the West then sticks its finger in and tries to manipulate the situation to its own advantage. So as we've just seen in Egypt last week, where the US supported the Mubarak regime and the army. Then it supported Morsi to keep out the radicals. Then it supported the radicals to get rid of Morsi. And in fact, all three groups, there's overwhelming evidence that they're... I mean, the US, the Egyptian army is funded virtually 100% by the Americans. The Muslim Brotherhood have been working with Western intelligence services since they were founded in the 1920s. The British gave them loads of money to begin with to try and undermine secular nationalists and continued to do so in the 50s. And a lot of the modern secular forces in Egypt have also been trained rebellious techniques by the CIA. So in other words, the idea that we are not trying to control the politics in Egypt is ludicrous. All three factions in Egypt are being bankrolled by us, by British and American taxpayers.
Is that you have actual evidence for that?
Just explain
those three factions again. That's really important, Martin. Obviously, the Brotherhood is one. The new Mohammed al-Baradei, a lot of people seem to think he was an ex-guy.
I can't remember the name of the organisation that just did all the process in Italy, in Egypt, but a lot of these people have had training in how to run protests. It started in Serbia at the end of the war in Yugoslavia. Otpor were mostly young activists taken out of Serbia and given training in Facebooking, Twittering, how to provoke the police to start an incident, all this sort of stuff. And this is going on. So the National Endowment for Democracy, all sorts of NGOs funded by the US government are involved with those kind of groups. So they're trying to control what you might call the radical secularist forces by giving them training and help. They're trying to control the Muslim Brotherhood forces by again giving them help and training and backing them. So Muslim Brotherhood regimes, wherever they've come to power, have supported the IMF's policies of withdrawing subsidies and so on, for example. And of course, the Egyptian army is basically 100% funded by the Americans, so of course they've got a say in that. So what the ordinary Egyptian in the street realises is that everybody, all the political forces in their country, are being manipulated by an outside power, that is to say, the United States, and behind the United States stands Israel.
So, they must be wondering, I mean, they were turning out on the streets again. We had a massacre outside the headquarters this week of the Muslim Brotherhood as well. I mean, are you saying that these things are kind of orchestrated in some way? Or I mean, what chance is there for ordinary people to actually get what they want in Egypt, which is quite clearly a government that just looks after their interests and isn't influenced by an outside state or another agenda?
Well, that's very difficult to do, and people all over the world are struggling for that, and it's very difficult to get there because the West, of course, there was a period when the West was taking a kind of, after the Vietnam War, for example, in the 70s, in the early 70s when Jimmy Carter was in charge in the US, there was a genuine attempt to try and reach out to the Third World and try and understand some of their concerns. But from 1980 onwards, we've just gone back to 19th century normality, which is we just interfere in their politics and they have to shut up and take it. But of course, eventually, of course, it's going to be an explosion.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, the prohibition of drugs in Britain is arguably doing more than anything else to support organised crime. And to discuss the campaign Normal, N-O-R-M-L, I'm joined by Chris Bovey, who's managed to come all the way from Totnes. Well done for making it through the traffic jams, Chris.
Yep, hi there.
Unfortunately, we did invite the Chief Inspector Paul Brunt from Avon and Somerset Police to come, but he's outside the Falls area this week, so we'll obviously keep plugging away to get him to come and give the Avon and Somerset Police point of view. But Chris, tell us about Normal. When did it start?
Originally in 1970 in America, stands for the Normalisation of Marijuana Laws. So that's over 40 years. And last year, we started up the first British chapter of Normal, Normal UK. You can see on our website is Normal, spelled NORML-UK.org.
Okay, so why is this such an issue for you? Why do you feel so strongly?
Well, I've been smoking weed for quite a long time. And, you know, I just feel belittled by these. I mean, we've just heard Martin here talking about the level of corruption of our governments. And yet I'm being told I can't smoke a plant by people who aren't really very, people I very much respect. And this, the basis for this prohibition is on a lie, basically. Various things they say on one hand the cannabis has no medicinal value, while on the other hand GW Pharmaceuticals are allowed to make a cannabis tincture, which are very strong skunk cannabis. Any problems that come from the illegality of the supply of cannabis generally are caused from prohibition itself. For example, the quality controls. If you went into a pub and bought a spirit, you wouldn't just have a random alcohol made by a bootleg spirit distiller and not know what percentage it is, not know what it is. When you smoke, when you use cannabis, it's really a good thing to know if that is a sativa or an indica. For example, a sativa is a more uplifting high, which is more suitable during the day, or an indica might be a good one for relaxing you or putting you to sleep. It's more medicinal uses. And also the relationship between the cannabinoids in cannabis, which is THC, which probably everyone's heard of, and CBD, which probably most people haven't heard of. Now, CBD is actually an antipsychotic. It misharvested in the later stages of cannabis growth, and because it's being grown by predominantly criminals on the black market, it's harvested early, so you're getting poor quality cannabis being sold, no regulation, it's costing a fortune to implement, and it's got high THC and very low CBD.
Well, this is all very easy to say, Chris, but ultimately the reason that cannabis is illegal is because it's dangerous.
And where's the evidence?
Well, there's all sorts of reports saying particularly that it can damage people's mental health.
There's all sorts. I believe the most the study which really looked at this was the Keele University study, which came to the conclusion that it didn't do this. I believe 1% of the population are at risk from psychosis. That's 1% of the population who probably shouldn't smoke cannabis, and of that 1%, even then, only a small percentage, even less, are at risk. I haven't got the figures in front of me, I'm not that organised, but if you Google it, Keele University study.
I mean, or your other favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, yes? The Keele University study.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Google on here, but I'm afraid, but I'll try and just remind people that there are all sorts of other search engines, not just Google out there. Anyway.
Yeah, well, there's also, he was talking about encryption earlier on. I'm not really bothered if the government are listening to my Skype chats. They might actually learn something. I hope they are. But should you wish to talk to someone, I imagine if you were up to skullduggery, they probably know this, but just use Jitsi, which is jitsi.org, and this completely will encrypt your chat, which could be AOL or Google chat, or
just do it in a park on a bench.
Yeah, but yeah, so you know, there is encryption software out there which
I assume people are using. Comment here. I mean, I keep on banging on about this, but the UN report on drugs and crime, which came out in 2009, was very revealing. It's put together by senior police officers from all over the world, and basically it said that during the banking crisis in 2008, all the dirty money from drug dealing, and we're not just talking about cannabis here, we're talking about cocaine and all the other stuff, was sucked into the banking system in one go, just like that. Yes. So in other words, the so-called private financial system is based on two pillars. One is the taxpayer, the long-suffering taxpayer. Two is drug money. And people say, oh, you can't say that all the banks are involved in laundering drug money. I say, yes, they can. Yes, we can.
Well, it was proven because they are. HSBC Mexico. Indeed. It was absolutely proven, which was in turn ultimately owned by the British HSBC.
Exactly. So what we end up is having an argument about whether cannabis is good
but
or bad.
Odd enough, somebody...
I would argue that possibly smoking too much cannabis is bad for you. Of course it is. If you get up every day and get stoned and you never get anything done, that's bad for you. So same as if you got up every day and started drinking. Vodka.
But maybe not necessarily for a medicinal user.
No, indeed. And also, of the drugs unfortunately, which are available to people, marijuana is clearly the least harmful of virtually all of them.
But sadly, the person who is growing medicinal cannabis for himself, maybe to treat something like multiple sclerosis, I know people who use cannabis there, they have the risk of having their door kicked down by the police. I don't recall the head of HSBC UK ever having his door kicked down and being unceremoniously taken to the police cells for all that drug laundering money, which is absolutely illegal under British law. It doesn't matter where the fact that it took place out of Britain, the fact that there was a British company involved with laundering drug money.
Well, the war on drugs is lost.
I don't even call it a war on drugs. I call it a war on some people who use some drugs.
Yes, it's very, very partial, isn't it?
Chris, we had a recording with former MI5 officer Annie Mashon, who was up at your normal conference a couple of months ago. And one of the things she was saying was that cannabis was first criminalised at the same time as alcohol was prohibition was stopped in the US, and that there were interests that were actually rather annoyed, I mean organised crime interests who were doing very nicely out of alcohol prohibition, that were behind that. What do you know about that?
Yeah, I've read this, and also they had a huge network of law enforcement officers where they created to police prohibition of alcohol, so then that just switched to prohibition of narcotics.
But I mean, surely you know the idea that there is a whole broad spectrum of different types of drugs. You know that you couldn't apply the same kind of legalities to heroin as you could to cannabis. Surely.
Well, yeah, I'm here to talk about cannabis predominantly. Although I think heroin, it should really be treated as a heroin addiction should really be treated as a disease. And in countries where there is pharmaceutical clean heroin available to addicts, where I believe it's such as the Netherlands, Switzerland, heroin use has actually gone down. So that's something I would consider looking at if the end result is that you want less people to use heroin.
Another thing that Annie mentioned was Portugal. She said that there's a decriminalisation of cannabis in Portugal. Can you just explain how that sort of system might possibly work here? I think, you know, it's very difficult for people to envision, you know, people being able to actually buy cannabis in a normal way without actually knowing how it would work, because you wouldn't want it to be just, for example, available to young children, etc.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, in the Netherlands, where cannabis is... kind of legally available through the coffee shops. I was in Amsterdam only a few weeks ago. Walk into any coffee shop if you're over 18 and buy cannabis. They have lower usage of cannabis amongst minors than they do in this country. Why? Because there are very, very strict sanctions imposed on coffee shops in the Netherlands who are caught selling to under 18s, that they just don't do it.
Yeah, I think we've got to distinguish between cannabis, which I think is a special case because it is such a harmless drug and so many people use it, and a lot less harmful than alcohol, and yet we keep it illegal. But I think the bigger question is all drugs, illegal drugs, create a market for criminals, including the intelligence services in this, like the CIA's involvement in the cocaine trade in the 1980s is well documented. And I think that ultimately we've got to legalise all drugs, including heroin. But of course, that doesn't mean we're going to say to people it's good to use heroin.
Or necessarily that you could buy it from the...
No.
local supermarket.
The real problem, I've thought quite deeply about this, the real problem is drugs like crystal meth, which don't in fact travel very far at all. If you know what you're doing, you can make crystal meth in your kitchen with, you know, basic equipment. And it's ravaging rural America, not inner city America. Rural America is being ravaged by crystal meth. It's an extremely nasty drug. Now, the only way you can stop, I mean, it's illegal already, but it doesn't stop people using it, and it's highly addictive. And the only way to deal with it is to make sure that everybody knows the facts about everything. You tell your young teenagers, look, you'd be much better off quietly smoking a bit of cannabis than doing this crystal meth, which is going to kill you.
Chris, I wonder if you could help us out a bit here with some of the, you know, just say no information. You were talking earlier on about different types of chemicals or highs or whatever you're involved with weed. One of the obvious things is, what is the difference between the sort of hard cannabis and the green stuff? You know, there's two completely different sorts.
Hashish.
Yeah.
Hashish traditionally comes from North Africa, from Morocco mainly, where the Moroccan government is quite heavily involved in the supply of it, but it's all unofficial.
Is that actually done legally or illegally or what?
Well, it somehow manages to find itself into Europe. Technically, it's illegal to import into the Netherlands, but there's plenty of coffee shops that have hashish.
I don't think there's any actual trouble for the organised criminal gangs to move this stuff around the world. We were hearing that they actually use submarines, you know, and you know, if you see one surfacing in the floating harbour in Bristol here, you know, it could be an organised crime submarine potentially.
They don't have any trouble.
I knew this Dutch Moroccan guy, and he was selling speedboats in Morocco, because if you buy a speedboat in Morocco, you have to register it with the authorities. So he was selling them for quite a good profit from the Netherlands to Morocco. Don't know what they were using them for.
But anyway, the difference between grass or weed and the hashish. Can you just explain what's the difference between the way that they're prepared, where they're made?
Well, hashish is just the press of they shake the flowers and the dust collects, and then it's pressed together. Often hashish will have a slightly more mellow high than maybe some of the grasses out there. And again, if we were talking about legalization and decriminalization of what they've done in Portugal, but it's kind of a halfway house measure, because it doesn't make the supply legal. So you can have it in your own possession, but you still have a problem where the supply is still being controlled by organized criminal gangs. They've got quite an interesting model in Spain with the cannabis social clubs, where people could get together and grow cannabis and share and sell between them. Again, in Spain, any possession of a drug for personal uses is not actually illegal.
I think that's quite interesting that Spain and Portugal, Catholic countries, have taken a more kind of pragmatic approach.
Well, a lot of countries, Belgium, the Czech Republic is also... America, two states in America have fully legalized, not decriminalized. 18 states have decriminalized marijuana to some form of effect, or allowing medicinal marijuana, but two states have fully legalized. They're going to tax it. That's another very important point, is the money that is spent on policing these daft laws for a substance that is arguably far less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco. And then, presumably, if it was permitted to be sold, you could have quality control, but the government could tax it as well. I mean, apparently the country's broke.
Yeah. I think we've got to distinct... I mean, I think the cannabis is a special case, because there's been a campaign to legalise it for, you know, several decades. But I think we're now moving to a situation where the idea of legalising all drugs is becoming more predominant, because in Latin America, for example, across the political spectrum, political leaders are saying, look, we just can't go on like this.
The illegal
market is leading to thousands and thousands of deaths every year on our streets.
Well, we had
and the human life has become cheap.
We had just a second, guys. We had Tim Lloyd on a few weeks ago, as well as Annie Mashon from MI5. Tim Lloyd is a former chief constable. Tom Lloyd, former chief constable of Cambridgeshire, talking about this. But there's also he's not the only former police officer who's is very interested in this subject. Another one is Rowan Bosworth Davis. He was also at the Normal conference, and so let's have a listen to what he had to say about ending prohibition of drugs generally.
I'm Rowan Bosworth Davis, former Metropolitan Police officer, and I'm now the president of LEAP, which is an international organisation. LEAP stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So I'm actually the president of the UK chapter, love that word chapter, don't you? Of the organisation, and what we're trying to do is to help to engineer and encourage and promote debate on the subject of prohibition of narcotics, but in a way we're hoping to help to get the government to promote this in a much more reasoned, much more moderate way, based on evidence rather than, you know, fantasy and some of the nonsense that gets churned out by the red top tabloid press.
You talk about evidence. What evidence have you got that prohibition is a bad thing? Because so many parents, they just don't want drugs to be out there on the market for their children to consume.
Now, of course they don't, and that's precisely the problem. That debate has been whipped up and has been driven by a very emotive and dishonest campaign that has been generated by those people who are opposed to this whole concept of people having a right to engage with narcotics. But there is another side to this coin, and that is that by maintaining this process of prohibition, we're not actually stopping children ingesting narcotics. No one's going to tell me that because we have these policies of prohibition that it's stopping kids, because we know it isn't stopping them. But what it is doing is creating an environment and helping to develop a market where, if you like, the government has completely washed their hands of the responsibility for controlling this market and put it into the hands of criminals. So you and I are now living in a country where we have an illegal market that is controlled by criminals, yet whole swathes of people refuse to debate the ways and means in which we can wrest that control away from the criminals and put it into the hands of the government.
But aren't you washing your hands of the whole business? Surely, as a former police officer yourself, it was your job to nail these criminals, and you haven't really done that.
Well, it's easy for people to say I haven't done it. I did the job that I was given, which was in the area of financial crime. But the fact of the matter is that trying to impose the law and trying to affect the law, they just aren't the hours and the day and the police officers available to do that.
Are you saying that the narco traffickers are actually stronger than the police, that they can actually outwit them every turn?
Well, that's not a question of stronger and outwitting them. It's a question of realities. They've got the money. They don't have to acknowledge the rules and the regulations and the courts of law. They don't have to abide by rules of evidence. So to the extent that are they better at doing what they're doing than the police? Oh, yes, of course they are.
That was Rowan Bosworth Davis there, former Fraud Squad detective of 12 years. Old Lady Broxford economist Martin Summers, are we heading towards being a narco state? Because once the drug money starts to get into the city, once it starts to get into the government, it gets pretty pernicious, doesn't it?
I think we are. I think the financial sector is, in fact, absolutely complicit in money laundering, has been for a long time. Another silly event that's happened in the last week is the coalition government are going to ban CAT, which has been used by Somali communities for hundreds of years.
It's sort of purely racist.
Yes, it's just causing trouble where there's no trouble. Where there's, you know, this is actually under control, just, and you're going to create an issue.
It's like banning a strong espresso.
Yes.
What is CAT?
It's mainly in the Middle East, Yemen, Somalia, and Ethiopia, where it's used, and it's been used for hundreds of years. People chew it, and it's like a stimulant. It's like a bit like chewing coca leaves. And of course, the other thing is that in South Africa, archaeologists found a clay pipe dating back 40,000 years, as used by the original inhabitants of South Africa. And what did it have in it? Cannabis. The cannabis became illegal in Britain, I believe, in the 1920s, because when we were running Egypt, all of the Egyptians were eating cannabis. That was part of their culture, was to eat cannabis. And that was regarded as a terrible thing, and they shouldn't do that. So British administrators sat on their verandas, sipping their double G&Ts, and saying that these people shouldn't be allowed to eat cannabis, even though they've been doing it for hundreds of years. What business is it of yours? Well, we're running the country, and we get what we want. And that is the reality. A lot of this is just racism and othering of people that we don't like. You know, they don't use the drugs we like, so they're good. So we're going to persecute them.
The 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act, which just says misuse. How can it be a misuse to be using a plant that grows naturally in the privacy of your own home that you might either be using for recreational reasons or medicinal use reasons? That is not a misuse.
Well, I mean, it's legalese, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
how legalese. Can a drug... I don't even believe that a cannabis can be legal or illegal. It's a plant. It does, just grows in the ground. It doesn't really make much... You can't really say something is illegal or illegal.
No, but as you all know, Chris, there's been a tendency for people to regard people who want to legalise cannabis as being sort of idealists and a bit soft-headed and all the rest of it. But the reality is the financial system is being absolutely corrupted by hard drugs and hard finance behind
them. That's why it's so been so good to have people like Tom Lloyd, an ex-chief constable of Cambridgeshire, or Rowan Bosworth Davis, an ex-detective inspector with the Met, and many others come out and say these laws are crazy. Well, apparently a lot of politicians will actually agree with you, but the second you put a TV camera or a microphone in front of them, they go...
We'll see what happens, Chris Bovey from Normal, when we get Chief Inspector Paul Brunt from Avon and Somerset Police in here in the next few weeks to discuss the matter. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. That was Chris Bovey. So time to sign off now. Up next is Cyrus the Virus, the typical topical Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems in Bristol and Councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Also thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers to his little debate with Sir Malcolm Rifkin we heard earlier on, and to Chris Bovey that we just heard there. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including our investigations into smart meters, etc. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and that will take you straight to this page on the BCFM website. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and I'll leave you this week with Myron Fagan, who's a Jewish writer who spoke in 1963 what he believed was a conspiracy of liberals.
However, the vitally important thing for all Americans, all you mothers of the boys who died in Korea and are now dying in Vietnam, to know is that our so-called leaders in Washington, whom we elected to safeguard our nation and our Constitution, are the betrayers, and that behind them are a comparatively small group of men whose sole objective is to enslave the whole world of humanity in their satanic plot of one world government. Now, in order to give you a very clear picture of this satanic plot, I will go back to its beginning, clear back in the middle of the 18th century, and name the men who put that plot into action, and then bring you down to the present, today's status of that plot. Now, as a matter of further intelligence, a term used by the FBI, let me clarify the meaning of the expression, "He is a liberal." The enemy, meaning the one-word conspirators, have seized upon that word liberal as a cover-up for their activities. It sounds so innocent and so humanitarian to be liberal. Well, make sure that the person who calls himself a liberal or is described as a liberal is not in truth a red. Now then, this satanic plot was launched back in the 1760s when it first came into existence under the name of the Illuminati. This Illuminati was organized by one Adam Weishaupt, born a Jew, who was converted to Catholicism and became a Catholic priest. And then, at the behest of the then newly organized House of Rothschild, detected and organized the Illuminati. Naturally, the Rothschilds financed that operation. And every war since then, beginning with the French Revolution, has been promoted by the Illuminati, operating under various names and guises. I say under various names and guises, because after the Illuminati was exposed and became too notorious, Weishaupt and his co-conspirators began to operate under various other names. In the United States, immediately after World War I, they set up what they called the Council on Foreign Relations, commonly referred to as the CFR. And this CFR is actually the Illuminati in the United States. And its hierarchy, the masterminds in control of the CFR, to a very great extent, are the descendants of the original Illuminati conspirators. But, to conceal that fact, most of them changed their original family names to American-sounding names. For example, the true name of the Dillons, Clarence and Douglas Dillon, once Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Department, is Lepowski. I'll come back to all this later. There is a similar establishment of the Illuminati in England, operating under the name of the British Institute of International Affairs. There are similar secret Illuminati organizations in France, Germany, and other nations, operating under different names. And all these organizations, including the CFR, continuously set up numerous subsidiary or front organizations that are infiltrated into every phase of the various nations' affairs.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on. This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.